that obviously once we get to 70% double dose vaccination, we've outlined the freedoms that exist for vaccinated people. However, don't assume that at 80% double dose vaccination, that unvaccinated people are going to have all those freedoms. I want to make that point very clear. For those of you who choose not to be vaccinated, that's your choice, but don't expect to do everything that vaccinated people do, even when we hit 80%, and I want to make that very clear. I don't want people to think they can sit back, let everybody else do the hard work, and then turn up when it's 80% and get everything else that vaccinated people are. I want to say very clearly that if you're not vaccinated, you will not have the freedom or the freedoms that vaccinated people have, even when we get to 80% double dose. But I don't want people to think, oh, I'll sit back, not get vaccinated, and then just wait and then let others do the hard work and then get everything that everybody else is getting. But I want to make very clear, at 80% double dose, our expectation is that those that are vaccinated will enjoy overseas travel, will welcome home, fully vaccinated Australians coming through Sydney Airport. But don't assume you can sit back and by choice participate in everything. I think all of us, I personally don't want to go into a workplace or a venue where there's unvaccinated people. That's just my personal choice. I would never have assumed someone in my position would have to make the decisions we've had to make on behalf of the people of the state. They haven't been easy decisions.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. We meet today in a city known for its strength, in a country with citizens known for their courage. And we've never needed more courage and resilience with the crisis facing Australia. Today I want to just run through a few things which I think the public should be aware of and their right to know. But before I do, I want to pay homage to Craig Kelly and the excellent leadership he's provided the nation. He's been the primary person responsible for what it is today, 46,000 Australians joining our party. And it's pretty clear that within the next month, we'll have the largest membership of any political party in Australia. And certainly in my 50-year experience in politics as a former director of the Nationals, the Liberal Party, and a life member of those parties, I've never seen or experienced so many people join a party so quickly. I think when we set up the LNP, the most people that joined the party was 685 in one day. When Craig Kelly announced that he was our leader in the party, our membership went up by 5,000 people in 24 hours. So that's an indication that people in Australia are not happy. They're not happy with their politicians. They're not happy with what they're doing. But today I want to talk about John Skerritt from the TGA. I want to respond to an article that was written by David Crow in the Sydney Morning Herald on Friday, where he said that the TGA was considering legal action or criminal charges against our leader, Craig Kelly, for a tweet that he put out. And that tweet was authorised the tweet on behalf of the United Australia Party, and as chairman of that party, I'm here now to explain to you what it was. First of all, what was tweeted was a copy of the TGA's own report, which I think has all been circulated here. You've got a copy of it. It was a government report. So it's an extraordinary situation where you've got a member of the Australian House of Representatives being attacked for doing nothing more than circulating a government report. First of all, the United Australia Party welcomes any legal action against Mr. Kelly. We look forward to it as an opportunity when John Skerritt himself can be subpoenaed, can be asked the questions about the 483 Australians that have died after having the vaccine, can be asked to say for the court and for the Australian people, what were their causes of death, and what did the TGA do to investigate that, and why is it justified to continue the rollout? Secondly, we can ask Mr. Skerritt on oath about the 46,000 adverse reports that his office has received, about what he's done about it. And thirdly, we can raise the question of how he's threatened media owners with the cancellation of advertising if journalists publish anything to do with a contrary view of the government and his attack on the freedom of speech. There'll also be a great opportunity to subpoena Greg Hunt to bring him before the courts so he can explain his actions as a minister. Of course, Craig Kelly has nothing to fear from circulating an Australian government report. He has nothing to fear or be intimidated about the resources. He has the resources to defend himself. He has the resources to expose what's happening with the TGA. And a serious question's got to be asked with Mr. Skerritt who's responsible for regulating drugs in this country, when we see him in a white coat on television promoting vaccines, is a serious conflict of interest between a regulator promoting a company's product. So we look forward to the United Australia Party, with John Skerritt being true to his word, commencing a legal proceeding to allow the real relevant evidence to be brought before the court. I would also say that on behalf of the party, we'll be standing candidates in 151 seats in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And you've probably seen overnight how Wayne Swan, the President of the Labor Party, has started to tremble and fear that he's got no chance in government. Because there is a great coalition in this country at the moment between the Liberal and Labor parties. They represent the real coalition to deny people their chance at an election time. And he knows that Labor will not become the next government of this country. And we're targeting those seats, and we expect to be very successful. Our initial polling indicates that. The overwhelming public support that we've had in membership indicates that. And we'll be moving on in the next 2 to 3 weeks to make a number of serious policy announcements about other areas of the economy besides just concentrating on lockdowns and vaccination policy. We have to think about how we're going to get the economy moving and how we're going to bring Australia back to where it should be, to full employment and freedom across our borders. So maybe with that, you may have some questions you want to ask me. I'm more than happy to answer them.
Clive, can you see that by standing here today, by, again, an elected Member of Parliament, Craig Kelly, can you see how people feel that what you're doing is a campaign of fear?
Sorry?
Well, tell
the people... Well, I missed the last two words.
About, we talked about campaign of fear.
Yeah. Well, it's not a campaign...
But, I mean, you're here... Look at all this information that you've passed on to us here about adverse reactions to
it's very serious. Yeah.
People want their freedoms back. The government's telling us that to get our freedoms back is to get this, to get the jab.
Yeah, and we're saying very clearly that if you want to get the jab or you don't want to get the jab is a matter of personal choice, right? But the Helsinki Accord, the Nuremberg Declaration, all say that people are entitled to informed consent. Now, this is an Australian government report published by the Australian government. It's not something that we've come up with. And people are entitled to their full informed consent. And all we're doing, really, and all Craig Kelly's doing, is saying true to his oath of office that he'll protect and defend the rights of all Australians. Now, you know, if there are serious side effects by these vaccines, and I would point out these are reports to the TGA, by physicians and others about deaths that have taken place following the receipt of the vaccines. And that's all they are, and that's all the report says. But people are entitled to know what the truth is, because the media won't tell them. And the media has been threatened with the loss of their advertising contracts. John Skerritt wrote to I think we put some ads on one of the local radio stations you saw a few weeks back. He wrote a letter to them telling them that the TGA wouldn't do it, and then immediately gave them the very lucrative advertising contract so that we couldn't get any airtime. And, you know, it's unprecedented in this country where you get the government saying that they will threaten the freedom of the press, the rights of people to know, by withholding government money for their advertising. And you get media owners who may need that money instructing their journalists that they can't run articles, they can't be critical of the government, that there isn't any fair reporting anymore in this country. So what do you do? Craig Kelly, as an elected member of the people, has sent a tweet. In closing, nothing more, no comments, but our government report so people can have informed consent. I don't see anything wrong with that. I think it's very commendable, and I'll be certainly supporting Mr. Kelly with all my resources, for sure, to defend his right to freedom of speech and the rights of all Australians to make an informed choice.
Has John Skerritt, has his lawyers been in touch with you? Have your lawyers been in touch with him, or is this all...
No, well, John Skerritt and lawyers haven't been in touch with me, or I don't think Mr. Kelly, but we've seen the threats that John's made, right? Certainly John has written me a letter which I responded to. I think I released that a few weeks ago. But, simple facts are that Mr. Kelly hasn't broken any law, that freedom of speech, despite the lockdowns, exists in Australia, that a different point of view should be given. And, of course, you know, we know from freedom of information and other reasons that there's been no COVID samples in Australia that they've been able to calibrate testing by, that they've relied on overseas studies and overseas things provided by pharmaceutical companies. And more concerning to me personally is the fact that both Pfizer and AstraZeneca would not allow their products to be sold in Australia unless the Australian government gave them a full indemnity. If they killed anyone or maimed them, they wouldn't be responsible, the government would be. So I find that a very disturbing thing, that the government didn't take the view and say, well, if you're confident in your product, you should stand behind it.
Bob, what would you say right now to the people of Sydney, New South Wales, 1,600 cases, 1,800 cases a day, whatever they're up to at the moment? It's horrible what's going on, and there's people dying in hospital.
Yeah,
we've seen people die in hospital. They're not dying of fake disease, they're dying of COVID-19. You're up here today, it's irresponsible.
Well, I don't believe that, you know.
But what would you say to those business owners that can't open their business
I would say it's terrible.
Their premier's telling them that the only way out is a double jab, and that's what they've been told.
Yeah, I'd say their premier's lying to them. I'd say that she's under an IPAC inquiry, that a particular lobbyist in Sydney controls the Liberal Party in Sydney and has told her that the only way she gets out of that inquiry is if she pushes the double jab, and that his clients are AstraZeneca, and his clients are Pfizer. That's what I'd say.
What about the business owner that's being told he can't open his doors until he double jabs?
If you let me answer your question, I'll answer it.
You're just answering with IPAC and
that's what
politics.
You asked me.
About people that are trying to open their businesses. People that have been told they have to double.
Well, if you don't want me to answer the question, answer the question to start with. That's what I'd tell them, and I'd say that what the Premier's telling them is not true, and that policy shouldn't be locked down. Businesses should be open, and the government's using this as an excuse to destroy them. And they know that.
Do you think that the Premier of New South Wales wants to destroy business?
I do.
Why would she do that?
Because
it's her economy.
Because she, as I tried to explain to you, that she's being directed by a lobbyist in Sydney who's being paid by AstraZeneca and by Pfizer tens of millions of dollars to get these policies through to make sure the vaccine is pushed. That's why. You asked the question, I gave you the answer. And that's my personal knowledge. And I'm happy to make a statement here to police or to anyone if they want to know what's going on. I'll be doing that. But they'll be named. But not only that. What's more important, as I said, 46,000 people, 20,000 from the western suburbs of Sydney, has decided to join our party. And we do live in a democracy in Australia at the moment, and there is an election coming up, and the government, the federal government, will be held account. I'll just see if there's anyone else who wants to ask a question.
Have you been vaccinated yourself?
No.
No, and what,
you
vaccinated?
Definitely not, no.
And is the policy of the United Party to stop the rollout together? Is that what you would like to
see? Well, I think in Australia, we've got a very good system of approvals normally for vaccines, over a 10-year period normally, 7 to 10-year period. And one of the major requirements is that there is substantial safety data at 2, 3, and 5 years. The other requirement is that there's safety studies for testing in pregnant women and for children. There's been no studies done of any of these vaccines. And what I'm in favour of is protecting that approval system. That's what I'm in favour. I'm saying if a vaccine hasn't gone through those approvals, we shouldn't be willy-nilly putting into the whole population. That's my point of view. But everybody, including members of our party, are entitled to their own opinion.
So people should have the option to get vaccinated?
Well, it's the option. It's freedom of choice in Australia. Well, I don't think there should be any law that requires people not to. I think a medical treatment should be between a patient and his doctor, really. He knows the individual's medical condition. It shouldn't be a blanket cover for anybody. It should be between the doctor. It should be a private thing. The Commonwealth Privacy Act requires medical records to be kept private, and we've long had that tradition in Australia. But suddenly we see directions from the police department in Queensland saying that people must be vaccinated or they lose their jobs, that teachers in New South Wales must be vaccinated or they lose their jobs, that there becomes a condition of employment that you take a medical treatment. Now, back in Nuremberg in 1947, the International Court of Justice said that was wrong. They said that following the treatments and experimentation that took place in World War II, they said individuals should have the right to decide what goes into their body and what doesn't. Section 51(23A) of the Australian Constitution prohibits coercion in relation to medical practitioners, would stop them from being coerced by any penalty or anything from giving their vaccine. And we see today that there is coercion taking place in our society. And we think it's wrong. And that's why Craig Kelly's got so much support. And that's why there's a big shift coming in the Australian electoral system. And it'll happen at the next election.
Who did Queensland Police say they have to have a jab?
Sorry?
You said Queensland Police have told people they have to have a jab.
Well, there's a direction from the Queensland Police Commissioner requiring all officers to have a jab.
And health workers have been told the same.
I understand that. I'm not familiar with that direction. I am with the Queensland Police one. I think it's by the 4th of October for the Queensland Police, although they're not suitable for duty, and I think the nurses are by the end of September.
Unions agree with it.
Well, they do, and that's the sad thing, because we normally have a diversity of decision in of opinion in Australia, and the media has always been famous, the Australian media, for many years, reporting two sides of the argument. And there are two sides of this argument, and people should be informed, and people should have the right to know. And we're saying they're not having the right to know, and they're not having the political choice when you get all of our political parties saying the same thing. There is good reason not to say it. Now, that's one of the reasons that we're doing what we're doing.
What do you think?
I'm happy to answer you, but I'll just ask if has anyone else got a question they want to ask or not?
Yeah, Clive, lots of Australians are complaining about
getting
spam text messages from
Craig Jones.
Can I expect to get more?
Well, you'll have to ask him, right? But I could give you some figures from the other side of the argument. 1,378,000 Australians got access to this report from the spam messages and spent time reviewing it and looking at it, and that's a reality. So I think that's the other side of the argument. Those people thought it was important enough for them to be able to download it or for them to be able to go through it. So, you know, there'll always be diversity of opinion. And of course, what Craig Kelly did was completely legal. When I was in Parliament, the government, the opposition, decided that political parties were exempt, that they could send text messages through. And of course, the Liberal Party and the Labor Party did that. But they never thought one of the minor parties would have the funds or resources to do that. So they thought it was a great joke. But now they know that other people can follow what their leadership in that area. That's what we did.
How many years the campaign war chest for the next federal election?
Well, yeah, I'm sure it will be the most well-funded campaign of any of the parties contesting the election. I'm sure we'll be having the most campaign workers, and I'm sure we'll be having the most members. That's how it looks at the moment. Well, we will be, but we can't give you all the news in one day. I'd like to give you, but I want to save some news for you for later on, and there is some exciting news coming. That's the big thing. So, with that, I'll thank you all for coming. I hope you've got the press release there, and you've got the TGA report, so you know exactly what was sent. I should just make one comment, and this is the TGA report for the 25th of the 8th. The one that was sent was the week before, right? But the figures are very similar.
About a week difference.
I think there was 438 deaths, and now there's 483 reported deaths, according to the TGA. We have to rely on them for the information. Thanks very much for your time. All the best.
Do you want to introduce yourself? You're an ex-soldier and you're a lawyer as well.
Yeah. So I'm a senior UK lawyer, so about 26 years practicing experience. I'm a litigator, but I am also a retired army officer. And I also, the other bit that's relevant is I used to work as a management consultant for 2 years. So when all this kicked off, I was drawing on each of those experiences to inform myself and seeing the red flags that come up all over the place. So I started working about a year ago with a team of lawyers. We gradually found each other and formed a team, and then reached out to the experts who were giving their evidence, taking down their expert evidence, analysing what was happening in terms of the legal position, reaching out to other teams abroad and then likewise. And then, as you know, I ended up going public and telling people what the legal analysis was, which was that it was including mandating, you know, medical apartheid. It's all against the law. So the burden of proof is actually on the state to prove to us, the people, that they have the lawful, legal, moral and ethical right to derogate from that core obligation to every single one of us.
And what about the lockdowns as well? Will you be challenging those in addition?
Yeah, absolutely, because all of those measures are causing harm. And we are a common law jurisdiction, and our first duty to each other is to do no harm. So the moment someone's causing harm to someone else, unless it's legal, lawful, moral and ethical, and people have consented to be harmed, it's all of those things. It's not legal, it's not lawful, it's not moral and it's not ethical. And people do not typically consent to be harmed. So it's everybody's citizen's constitutional duty to prevent somebody else within our democratic society from harming someone else. And you have to take action. You can't can't omit to act because, under our jurisdiction, omitting to prevent harm is as guilty as causing harm yourself. You don't get to stand by and watch your fellow brother or sister suffer. So, yes, all of those measures that are causing harm have to be, challenged, and they have to be justified with evidence that they are proportionate, they're necessary in a democratic society, that they have the right to derogate from their core obligations, and they don't have any of those rights. So,
what I wanted to ask, obviously, we have fundamental natural rights.
Sorry, guys, I hope you don't mind. I've been so thirsty. I've been standing on Parliament Square all afternoon. Someone's just given me half a cider.
Oh, that's okay. I wanted to ask, because obviously we have fundamental natural rights as the common law jurisdiction. We have the Magna Carta, we have the Bill of Rights, and before that, you have the general sort of common law as it was understood by the people, which is, no injury, loss or harm. Do you think that what Parliament's doing now is essentially asserting a sort of divine right of Parliament rather than the previous divine right of
kings? Absolutely I do. In fact, I'm really glad you point that out, because that was my analysis as well. We've transferred the divine right of kings onto the divine right of Parliament, it seems, according to Parliament. And our constitution doesn't work like that. We have the checks and balances in place, and you talk about the common law being the highest law. It's not, it's God's law. We are a Christian nation and have been on record for at least 2,000 years, basically since Christ was born. And that's official according to the Edict of Thessalonica, which is 385 AD, which was issued by the Roman emperors at the time, and we were part of the Roman Empire. And it was decreed that we, as part of the Roman Empire, our official state religion was Christianity. And that's remained the case ever since. So under our constitutional oath, the monarch's oath, it says that the Queen, to the utmost of her ability, utmost of her power, rather, will uphold God's laws in accordance with the Old and New Testaments and the Gospels, as well as our common law. Because common law is just man-made law. It sits under God's law in this constconstitution.
Well, you might say that common law is based upon natural law, which comes from nature.
And
therefore, some people, I wouldn't say myself, but some people say, well, natural law comes from nature, which comes from God. Other people say natural law comes from nature, and nature is science. So there are different ways to sort of arrive at natural law.
Yeah.
But surely natural law is supreme. What do you think of the way that the courts have been operating now, where, when I went to my case, I said, well, now there's this lockdown, this is the only theatre open in town. What do you think of the courts?
Oh, what do I think of the courts? A whole variety of things, because, like any profession, there are some people within the profession who are absolutely upholding the rule of law and administering justice and complying with their duty, and then there are others who aren't. And so we've got a mixed picture, in the same with we have with the doctors. What our job is to try and wake up the other lawyers who seem to be believing the narrative, call them out for standing by and watching these things happen. So I, for example, have been pointing my lawyer friends to the judgment of the judges and the lawyers in the Nuremberg trials, because judges and lawyers were brought to account in the same way that media professionals were, bankers were. It wasn't just the soldiers who were held accountable. Anybody in society who had a position in which they could have exercised their power and their duty to stop what happened, what was happening, was held accountable. Or rather, they were accused. Some of them were held accountable, but some of them were found not guilty. But, the judges put forward an argument that they didn't know what was going on. That was their defence. They said, well, the reason we didn't say anything or do anything is we didn't know what was going on. And the tribunal said, you have the transistor radio and the word on the street. Well, we now have the internet and the transistor radio and the word on the street. So for anybody to raise the defence that they didn't know what was happening is not going to wash in accordance with the judgment, international case law, of the International Military Tribunal, because they've already heard all of those excuses. So when then the judges said, oh, well, we did know what's going on, but we decided that we ought to stay in positions of power because otherwise worse people would come in, to which the tribunal said, but according to the public, you stayed in your position and you said nothing, so you were complicit. And that's what I would say at the moment, that anybody in any profession who knows what's going on and is staying silent. Unfortunately, the military tribunals, international case law, goes against them. So they need to read those, look at what they're doing and omitting to do, and work out which side of the law they want to stand on. Because that legal position has already been analysed in the past by our ancestors, bless their hearts. And the law is already there. So anybody who's not standing up, who's not, you know, actively stopping harm from happening to all of us, is not complying with the law.
So are we headed for a second Nuremberg trial?
Yeah, basically. Across the world. I mean, legal teams, what's extraordinary about working with lawyers across the world is that they're all saying the same thing. And I've said to people, well, either we're all stupid, but in which case, how have you been practicing all those years if you were really that stupid? Or we're mad, but again, same argument. These are lawyers practicing for 20, 30 years. And it doesn't matter which jurisdiction lawyer I've spoken to, they're all saying the same thing, the same legal analysis.
And why do you think more lawyers haven't spoken out?
You'd have to ask them that. I know why some of them haven't. There are actually more lawyers working on this than people realise. And they are in difficult positions because, you know, for a variety of reasons, and I don't want to speak on their behalf. But there are some really good lawyers who the public won't know are doing a really good job, but I would be able to vouch for them because they've been on it the whole time, but behind the scenes.
Do you think that there's a sort of lack of real British and historical education in this country, and that leads to this sort of lack of an understanding of our constitution?
Absolutely, yeah. When does it get taught in school what our basic constitutional rights are and duties? And it's really important to stress the duty. You know, it's not just about taking and enjoying the freedom of our rights. You know, rights are hard won.
Two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. You know, these are our ancestors fought and died for these time and time and time again. And that's one of the reasons I'm standing, because my own ancestors did. You know, on both sides of my family, they've served in both world wars and they all survived. But, you know, that's what they did. And my great-uncle William Harvey was one of the first into Gallipoli, and there's a website dedicated to him. And you can read his letters from the front line. You know, what did he do all of that for? My uncle Sam was caught in a German prisoner of war camp, had to escape, and got all the way back through the France and Spain with the resistance, came back to England and went over for another pop. You know, so they didn't do all of that so that we could sit here and just say, oh, well, none of that matters, none of our rights matter, you know. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So, yes, I do blame the education system and society generally, because, you know, you cannot uphold your rights if you don't know what your rights are. And I often say to people, well, have you looked at the Bill of Rights, or have you looked at Magna Carta, or have you looked at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or have you looked at, you know, the international conventions that set out all your rights? And most people say, well, no. And I say, well, how are you going to uphold your rights if you've not looked at what they are? And I understand, of course, that, you know, I'm a lawyer, so it's easy for me to know where to find all these laws. But actually, if you just Google, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, for example, it comes up in Google. And it's in very plain English. It's not legal, complicated document. So, and it's written in that way so that everyone can read it and understand what their fundamental rights are. So I would really, really encourage everyone. You know, the right, people's rights are getting flouted because people don't know what their own rights are. And actually, they've got all the law on their side to stand in their own sovereignty and to demand not to be harmed by all these measures. You know, so I really please everyone start informing yourself, which is one of the reasons I'm going public, because if I can tell people about their rights, you know, in a straightforward way, then hopefully more and more people will be aware of what their rights are.
Well, yeah. And is there anything like you'd like to say?
Well, thank you for giving me a platform. Yeah, I'd really like to give everyone hope that, you know, frankly, when you look at the work that lawyers have done over at least 200 years, And I mean, that's a snapshot. But when you look at the work that lawyers have done for 200 years, all the laws are in place to protect each and every one of us from what's happening. We have individual rights of bodily integrity, right? We have an old maxim, and I can't remember the exact Latin phrase, I never studied Latin, but the interpretation is that, you know, over his or her own mind and body, everyone, each person is sovereign. And that was common law way before the Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights, saying you've got the right to your own body,
like,
and nobody can force
kingdom.
yeah absolutely, it's a fundamental tenet. But again, it's God's law, right? You are sovereign and you get to choose what happens to your body, and you get to choose what happens to your mind, and you get freedom of speech, and all of those laws have been enshrined for millennia. So, you know, the idea that a group of people can come in 2020 and 2021 and say none of the rule of law matters, the constitution is irrelevant, we get to set aside all these rules for a has never been proven to anywhere in the world. None of the legal teams have agreed that this is, they all say there's been no evidence that it actually 99 unless you're over, I think it's 70 with etc, etc. So the idea that we get rid of our entire constitutional laws, we forget about what everyone fought and died for all that time because of this one, is ludicrous. So yeah, have hope, everyone, because the legal framework is there to prove that, you know, you don't have to suffer all this harm. It's a duty to take action. More and more people are taking action. So, you know, that's only a matter of time. And ultimately, we have the precedent. You know, no oppressive regime has ever lasted because we, the people, stand up.
And where can people find information? And your name as well?
Yeah, it's Anna de Buisere. On Telegram, there's something called the Informed Consent Campaign, because this is my main mission, is to inform everybody about the fact that they can refuse to consent to these things. You have to be informed, it has to be freely given, you have to be given all the information, you can't be coerced, you can't be threatened, you can't be sanctioned, it all has to be complete free will. So the Informed Consent Campaign is giving lots and lots of people the legal position and the tools in which to stand in their own sovereignty and to understand more about consent. Because it doesn't just go for medical treatment. You know, we are governed by consent. If we don't consent to the measures that are being employed against us, it is our sovereign right and our democratic right and our legal, lawful, moral and ethical right to say no, I don't consent. This is harming me, it's harming other people, I don't consent. So the Informed Consent Campaign on Telegram, we're also building a website called the Informed Consent Campaign. It's being under construction at the moment, so it's not up and running. So those are the two main places at the moment, but, you know, we are working on getting a better platform so that people can contact each other and download the information. But we're a bunch of volunteers. Bear with us, please.